Hello and welcome to the Industry Leaders Podcast, where we talk to the leaders of some of the most exciting direct and retail brands and learn the real stories behind their success, their challenges, and their plans for the future. I'm Sarah Cole Boyle, and this podcast is brought to you by More2, the marketing science people. Now, my guest today is a little bit different, and I am delighted to welcome him to the show. If you've listened to our episode with Nathan from Mamas and Papas, you might recognize the name Mike Barry. I don't think Nathan will mind me saying this, Mike, but he was absolutely singing your praises for the work that you did with him and Mamas and Papas and their ESG strategy. And he was actually so complimentary that we decided that we had to go and get you on. So it's absolutely brilliant that you're here. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Delighted to join you today on a bit of a cold, grey day here near London. And it reminds me of when I did the work with Nathan in Huddersfield, north of England. It was a scorcher. Another sort of climate disrupted day. We're all sort of dripping with sweat as we worked through what needed to be done. And it's a little bit of a reminder how quickly the climate is changing, even on these sort of typically wet and windy aisles.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So that's really what we're going to dive into today. But before we get started, Mike, I wonder, could you give me a little bit of a potted history of what you did at M&S specifically? What were you put in there to do and how did you go about it?
Oh my goodness, I'll be very brief because at my age, there's so much you could say, but I'll avoid it. So, you know, who's Mike? Chemist by degree, three wonderful kids, 22, 20 and 18. I say that because that matters enormously to me and their future. I joined M&S in 2000, so 23 years ago now, and I was recruited by the then Chief Financial Officer, Alison Reid, which seemed really odd because I was recruited to do this really lowly environmental job, but I saw 14,000 of one into 1,000 shops. And I thought, why is the CFO recruiting me? And she said, day one, you know, in this very plush office in the M&S Towers, Mike, confession to make, no one else in the business really gives a toss about this, but I do. I have no remit for the environment, but I've smuggled you into the business as my executive financial assistant. That's what the HR team think you're here to do. Clearly you're not. You don't know anything about finance, don't go anywhere near my financial books. I will give you air cover and protection, but basically you've no land manager, no budgets. There's one other lad who's working hard in the space, that guy called Roland Hill, brilliant, M&S Life, and knew it inside out. Get out of my office and sort this green thing out. So for 4 years, we had a brilliant little band of brothers and sisters that worked across the business to drive change. Inspiring leader Stuart Rose came in to fight off a very ugly takeover attempt by Philip Green for the business. And Stuart said, I believe in this. I really want to be the world's best retailer on sustainability. Go do. If you don't, you'd be looking for a new job. So in space of less than 100 days, we wrote what became quite famous as Plan A, because there's no Plan B for the one planet we've got. 100 social environmental commitments, 2007 to 2012. It saw the future to a degree. It saw this thing called Scope 3. It took responsibility for M&S's impact in its supply chains and consumer use of its products. It saw the importance of business case, which I'm sure we'll talk about today. This is not just about doing nice things. It's about doing the right thing for your business value in the future. It saw the need to integrate and engage everybody in the business, not just have a small specialist team to do it. So I sort of helped launch that plan. I helped update it. But crucially, the reason the viewers can't see Mike's grey hair, but there's plenty of it, is I stuck there to help implement it, which is tough. And I've got a lot of wounds and scars and learnings from that, which I'll share some of those with you today. And, you know, came out of the business in 2019, loved my time there, but pretty exhausted. The last 4 years, I've just been freelancing across the economy, helping multiple different businesses, beyond retail and FMCG, help them reach their potential and sustainability. Love it to bits. You know, I can't imagine not working in some shape or form deep into my dotage, but there's never been a greater imperative, but also an opportunity to be driving this agenda in your business.
Mm. And you mentioned the business case there, so I want to kind of jump in on the big question. Right now, you know, brands, all businesses are focusing on trading profitably. How can you prioritize sustainability in a profitable business plan? How do you make those two things meet?
I'm smiling because, you know, in those 19 years at M&S, I think we only paid out a bonus two or three times. So I was always working on Plan A's with the rest of the team against a very difficult backdrop. You know, boards were coming and going. There were threats of takeovers again. There was cuts and challenges, even where the rest of the marketplace was doing fairly well. So what I'm about to say is grounded in the reality of working in a difficult financial environment and appreciate what it's like today. So let's just unpick what the business case is. And I'm just going to put five bullet points into the room. I think the first phase for M&S was an internal risk management exercise to say, look, we're getting campaigned against a lot, fish sourcing, wood sourcing, labor rights, animal welfare. we just need to get a grip of it, because we seem to be on a Friday night, quarter to midnight, dealing with a call from every journalist saying, what are you doing? And we don't know. So the first thing we did was just get a grip on that brand reputation issue. Second part of that was making sure we got a grip on cost base. You know, it seems self-evident now, but energy costs were nothing like they are today. But we took a huge chunk out of M&S's operating cost base in those first few years by focusing down on energy use in the stores, logistics, food waste, materials. We saved the business £750 million over 10 years. And that was incredibly important money for M&S to reinvest into its rebirth. So that was where we started off. It was very much about risk and compliance. The second phase was starting to understand that our employees, 84,000 people that worked so hard for M&S through all this change, wanted to work and do want to work for a business that has a heart and a soul, a purpose and a passion. And they were delighted to feel that they were working hard for good careers, relatively good salaries in the retail marketplace, but they were working for a business that cared and enabled them to care and make a difference as part of their day job. So it was about energizing and driving that workforce through a lot of change because they're working for a purpose-led business. The third part of it was very much about working to sort of reduce operational and supply chain disruption from ever more weather extremes. So, you know, I remember M&S's Sheffield store being flooded out by extreme rain. Huge disruption of supply chains, both in the UK and across Europe and the world, by drought or flood. So it's about making sure that M&S and its suppliers had a grip on that sort of risk architecture to the business's smooth flowing. The penultimate bit, the fourth bit, was about starting to engage the customer in the 32 million people who shop with M&S and the M&S difference. And M&S had lost its way by the early 2000s. It dominated the 20th century around the word quality, democratized the quality for the masses, quality shirt, quality packaging, quality food. By the early 2000s, lots of people were doing it, and M&S was struggling to explain its relevance. So we sort of worked to reinvent the word quality around emotional quality. Good for you, clearly, but good for planet and people as well. So it gave M&S a relevance as, again, it scrabbled for its new sense in the 21st century. It gave it a new sort of purpose in a very challenging marketplace. And I think that was really important for the business. And then the final thing is, you know, where we are today, which is starting to prepare for new products, new services, new categories. We've already seen it in the energy system, from fossil fuels to renewables. We've seen it in mobility, the shift from internal combustion engine to diesel and petrol. The same level of profound shift will come in consumer goods. Resale platforms for clothing is a beginning. Alternative proteins is a beginning in the world of food. But that's scratching at the surface of what will come in the future. So to me, they're the five building blocks of sustainable change.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk to the leaders of a brand, whether that be M&S or someone smaller, you know, might be a one-person team, how can they adopt a sustainability mindset? How can they embed sustainability in everything that they do?
So I think the first and obvious place, and I'm saying this very humbly because I led a team of 10 people out of 84,000 at M&S. Most SMEs, smaller businesses, don't ever have the ability to have more than half an FTE on this, if not just the owner trying to do it. So I think the first thing is be clear about what your impacts are. I mean, I work for a huge business with a huge array of 100 different social and environmental impacts. Most businesses are not like that. So what are the two or three dominant things that drive your social and environmental impact? How do you employ people? What do you like as a neighbour to the community around you? You know, what's your energy cost and carbon impact associated with it? What's your resource use and circularity opportunity associated with that? So you've got to know where you're beginning from. The second thing is that business case I just rattled through from M&S. Why do you need to do this? And for some businesses, it will be because, like M&S, they've got a very visible consumer presence in the marketplace and need to stand for something. For others, it's because their young workforce want to see it being done. For others, it's about cost base and reducing it. For others, it's because they supply into a supply chain of a very big business. Let's just use Tesco as an example, which increasingly want their suppliers, big and small, you know, to be moving forward in this space as well if you want continued access to their shelf in the future. So there are many different drivers for each business uniquely. So my second point is make sure you understand what those drivers are. And the third thing then is I'm a great believer, 80-20 rule. 20% of what you do is probably a unique opportunity for your business. M&S's ability to win in a difficult marketplace. 80% is about shared change because it's difficult. Little example, palm oil. Palm oil is used heavily in the food industry, about 20% of food products, associated with devastating deforestation in Southeast Asia, Malaysia and Indonesia. M&S wants to stop that deforestation in its food products. Right thing to do. Wow, it's hard. It's a liquid commodity bought 7 steps away from you. So M&S has to work with Tesco's and Sainsbury's and Walmart and Pepsi and Coke to sort of co-create a shared solution there. Same with the government policy level. You know, there's an organisation in the UK called RAP that's bringing multiple different food and drink companies together to make sure that everybody's gathering the same data on their impacts and sharing up and down. So 80% of it is about making sure that you're working in partnership with the rest of your sector to drive change rather than to do it on your own. But be clear about the 20% that's your secret sauce to help you uniquely win.
Mm-hmm. And if you have a brand who, let's say they have investors who have high targets and, you know, they're aggressive, let's say, if we use that word, and you have someone a bit like, you know, when you're at M&S and they're saying, how do I demonstrate the value of an ESG strategy to the company or to the investors? How do you do that?
We keep circling back to this business case, and I'm not embarrassed to say it. I believe passionately we need a better future, and I'm deeply worried about the future we're stepping into. But I think businesses have got to see the value opportunity for doing this. So I'm not going to repeat that, but I do think it's not enough to have it loosely in your head, just sort of kicking around thinking, oh yeah, it's better for our people and for the planet and our cost base. You've got to be able to turn it into numerics, quantify it. So again, we work really hard at M&S to build, and again, most businesses don't have to do something as complicated as Plan A, but to make sure that each quarter we could report to the business, we spent X pounds on energy efficiency, we'd save 2X pounds. We did the same on logistics and fuel use, the same on plastics, the same on carry bags, the same on coat hangers. So you have to have a really quantifiable evidence for those, both internally and those that, you know, own you or are important to you, to show them that this is actually making a difference for you. You need to track it. And again, I'm being hugely humble here with maybe a lonely SME audience to say, you can't have one or two people doing this full time. But you've got to weave it into your KPI narrative about how your business is running on a day-to-day basis. And at least half of what's spoken about, you'll be gathering anyway. You'll know what your energy bill is because you're a good commercial organization. You know how much you're spending on raw materials. You'll know the motivation and morale of your teams. You just need to make sure that that's adding into your knowledge about your sustainability business case.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought up the word quantify, because I think that's a really, really important word to talk about. I think specifically when you're looking at the customer, how you're communicating with the customer, how do you avoid looking like you're greenwashing?
Yeah, great question. And I'm reminded, yet, you know, yesterday it was Delta Airlines, the day before it was Lufthansa. You know, there's any number of companies being rightly challenged on greenwashing using these very loose terms like carbon neutral and, you know, we're offsetting. I'm going to give you the big picture as a big brand would see it, like an M&S, and then I'll narrow it down. So let's start with where customers' heads are at the moment. So there are four segments of consumers, as I would see it, on green issues. 10% of people are passionately green, and everything they do in how they consume or avoid consuming, let's be clear, is driven by the lens of sustainability. But it's only 10%, and that number's been pretty stuck there for a decade. There's a second group of 35% who are light green consumers. So what they're saying is, I want great product, I want, you know, great holiday, great food, great fashion, well-performing financial products, but I also want them to be much greener than they are today. And I meet many business leaders who throw up their arms and say, well, sir, madam, you can have it cheap but destroying the planet, or you can have it expensive and saving the planet, your choice. And I just think that's rubbish. I think there's a way of squaring the circle to deliver for people products that are fundamentally better for the planet and brilliant for the end consumer. And those people who get out of bed in the morning thinking, oh, it's impossible, will be squeezed out of the market. Now, that's not to say there aren't some significant short-term headwinds to bring price parity into the marketplace for those light green consumers, there are. But again, we can talk about it a little bit later. There are tactics to deal with that greening. The third group of people is another 35%. Who are deeply concerned about the future. Deeply, deeply, deeply concerned about the future. But their lens is much smaller than the light green consumers. Born in Manchester, live in Manchester, die in Manchester. What's anybody doing for Manchester? Don't talk to me about the Arctic and the Amazon. Show me that by being more sustainable, it will create better air quality, water quality, less litter, safer streets in Manchester, green jobs for my kids and their kids to grow up doing. And again, just taking us away from the UK for a moment, in the States, Joe Biden's done a really clever job with something called the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, that's brought $370 billion of subsidies into green production in America, sort of get those jobs back off China. And a lot of that money is flowing into middle America that lost jobs to China 30, 40 years ago when the steel mills and the coal mines shut. And they're now building wind turbines and batteries and electric cars, creating really good quality jobs for people, their communities. And that's what matters to a lot of people. And the fourth and final segment is 20% of people are not engaged at all. And that's mainly driven by poverty. Too poor to engage. And particularly in this current climate, let's respect that. but you don't need 100% of people engaged to change the system. Now, so having rattled through that world, let me point first into this greenwash world. So apart from the 10% who are passionately green, most people are on the edge of this shift. You know, I'm sort of interested in green, but I'm a bit worried it costs more. I'm a bit worried I'm going to have to sacrifice some sort of quality and sort of aspiration to get there. And we're reassuring them that don't. And this is where greenwash is so pernicious, because what greenwash does, it undermines confidence in the sector. I'm just about to buy green, and suddenly, you know, there's been exposé to see that the claims from this big business are BS. You know, they won't stack up in the court of law. And a lot, some of it is mendacity, businesses doing it deliberately wrong. But even more of it is because businesses just do it wrong. And there's a great report out from an organization called Planet Tracker. And they've looked at six types of greenwashing out there, and it's a fairly good guide for businesses to say, do this, don't do that. The Competition and Markets Authority in the UK, the Advertising Standards Agency, have come out with guidelines as to what, how to do it properly. But you want to be really careful about greenwashing, because as I've seen over the last 30 years, once your reputation is poor in the space, even if it wasn't deliberate, you've ended up in a bad place. It's so hard to get your reputation back. So I would almost say to anybody listening to this, don't make a claim just yet until you're absolutely confident that it stacks up and you can back it up in the marketplace.
Okay, brilliant. And can we dive into the tactics on that just a little bit? How do you do it well? How do you avoid the accidental greenwashing?
So first things first, the first is data. So we live in this sort of data and digital world. It's just as important on sustainability as any other aspect of our lives. So again, I worked for a small retailer, M&S. It sells billions of items, food items, clothing items each year. That's small. Walmart's 25 times bigger than M&S. It probably shifts 100 billion items a year. There'll be fast-moving consumer goods brands out there, you know, the big global titans that are shifting hundreds of billions of items a year. You're increasingly having to prove on an item level where it came from, what its impacts are. Not enough to just say, I'm a big business, I've got a net zero goal on a press release, and that's me protected from greenwash accusations. Quite far from it. You need to be able to prove that at an item level that this change is happening. Now, that's not possible with a spreadsheet. Simply can't do it with a spreadsheet, pen, paper, email, and abacus. With big data, with machine learning, with our dear friend artificial intelligence, you can start to get your arms around these staggering data sets. And again, there's been a new platform in the UK has been developed called the Food Data Transparency Project, FDTP, which is starting to bring consistency across all the data that flows through across all the supermarkets and their suppliers to make sure it's robust, it's consistent, it's gathered efficiently, important in this marketplace, but it underpins claims made by businesses. So that's number one. Number two is educating your team. So I've just had a chat with the good people at Diageo recently, again, the purveyors of Guinness to the world, and my favourite beers. And they were talking about how they've put their entire marketing team through a education course on how to make sustainable claims. Global business, I appreciate. It's not the same as a smaller entity maybe listening to this. But making sure that your PR team, your comms team, your marketing team are literate in this space. And it's not rocket science. I've talked about the ASA, the CMA, etc. There are a reasonable amount of advice out there to help you navigate through it. The third thing is just a reminder to everybody where I started this conversation about M&S and the word quality. So I meet lots of businesses dash into the marketplace, say, oh, there's this new green thing out here. Let's slap a green label on our product. And actually, apart from the 10%, most people are indifferent to that. They want to see that green is part of your brand proposition. So M&S's brand proposition is quality. So making sure that sustainability slots into that quality proposition that says this is a high-quality product produced to high standards for you and for the planet makes sense. So making sure that you're not clunking an environmental label into your offer just for the sake of it, again, avoids problems. And that's the final point. If you are going to use labels, use credible ones. There's ones like the MSC for fish, FSC for timber, Fairtrade, very obviously, organic, but there are many, many others which are starting to emerge. And actually, again, I'm just 60 seconds of digression. I don't think you're going to walk into a Tesco supermarket in 5 years' time and look at 100,000 products with 100,000 labels on them. Yeah, it's madness. You've got 10 minutes to do your shopping, you're on a budget, kids are crying, you ain't going to look at billions of labels. What Tesco's will do is it will say, first and foremost, for those 100,000 products to be on our shelves, you've got to prove to me, Tesco's, that they are good, ethical products, and they will therefore use labels almost as an internal policeman or woman project to make sure that what they allow on their shelves has first passed a Tesco's test. And then we'll increasingly see things, and again, I won't use Tesco as an example because it's pretending I know what they're going to do, but you'll see loyalty systems increasingly tracking your purchases, 60 products you put the product in your basket this week. Here's the carbon footprint in total. Next week, you might want to buy X, Y, and Z as an alternative, reduce your basket carbon footprint in your basket. Here's some reward points for doing the right thing as well. So there are all aspects of the continuum of how to avoid greenwash in the future.
Okay. And for someone who isn't as big as Tesco and doesn't have the people power to put in their own quality labels, check out their supply chain from start to finish, are there any certifications that you would recommend that you find really good and robust?
So a tough one, and rightly a tough one, but actually the best, is B Corp certification. Because B Corp does, it looks at the totality of how your business operates across all dimensions of social, environmental, and economic. And it just says, here's a stamp of approval to say everything that comes out of this business, product and service, is a good one. And you don't have to think beyond its B Corp as well. Now, up front, that's an effort and a cost to get. And you've got to think about that, again, in the current climate, as to whether that's right for you. But my experience says, in the current world we live in, getting B Corp certification is by far the best thing to do.
Okay. And do you think it's better to put a champion into the business, one person whose responsibility is to get that certification, or one person who is kind of the evangelist on green issues? Or is it something that everybody needs to be doing 20% of the time?
Again, go back to what I said about I led a team of 10. I reported to the chief exec, but my fellow directors had teams of thousands of people at M&S. My job was not to do sustainability for them. It was to encourage them to integrate sustainability into their area. Marketing, construction of stores, running logistics, buying products, running supply chains, etc. And by integrating it into what they did, making sure that they could see the value case of doing that. They became more efficient, they motivated their teams, they differentiated their product offering. So I was a coach and a mentor for the organization. So when we see an evangelist or somebody doing it for an organization, I'm slightly nervous because everybody looks at them and thinks, yeah, good old Mike over there, he'll sort this technical stuff out. The person, if you do have a lead person, and it's not for everybody, but if you do, you want that person with great coaching and mentoring skills. So, of course, do the heavy lifting for a busy organization and everybody else doing their day jobs. But to make sure they understand why you're doing it. And when you step back after 6 months of intense work, they keep pushing it because they understand why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, brilliant. And can you point out a couple of brands to me who, aside from M&S, who we know are great, but any brands who stand out to you as doing a really good job?
Let's just sort of pick out a couple. I think some of the fast-moving consumer goods businesses now, again, I appreciate the huge compared to maybe some listening here, but the Unilevers, the Danones, the Nestles, the Coca-Colas, I think have done a really good job. And I'm going to sort of put for 60 seconds an argument into the room that is not relevant to most on this call just yet. So I mentioned right at the beginning of the conversation that the transformation of the car system from being internal combustion engine to EV. And that requires a radical change to every aspect of what it means to be a car company. Every nook and cranny needs to change of its value. The food, drink, consumer goods sectors that you know I come out of have not yet entered that transformation yet, where we look and think in 2035, we'll be selling a radically different products and service producing a radical. But we're in the foothills of it. So those names I've just given, I do tremendously respect as leaders in the world of FMCG. But they're in the foothills of doing something I call making your existing business model less bad. So they're just shaving, you know, 3% less carbon, 2% less human rights abuse, 3% less animal welfare problems. Each year it's good, but all around the world's population is growing, the middle class consumer base is growing, and any sort of shaved savings that we collectively made is swamped by the rising tide of more stuff for more people. So I would challenge everybody in the marketplace who are of that scale to be looking over the horizon saying, yeah, good beginning, but we need to do so much more in the future. You then look in sort of the world of startups, and I'm going to declare a vested interest. So I work with a little organization called Kite Insights to run something called the Climate School. And what it does, it's a tool that helps educate the workforce of big businesses, a systemic version of this conversation, how to drive change as well. The ability to do that is really interesting. The third thing I'm really interested in is businesses that support their supply chains and business partners to do this because it's really hard. So I do a bit of work with the Climate Pledge, 400 companies around the world working on net zero, which is sharing best practice on how a big business, like a Ford, can support 50,000 suppliers on this journey rather than expecting 50,000 suppliers to do it on their own. I'm really interested, I talk about data and digital, I think all the big players like AWS, Salesforce, Google, Microsoft are starting, again, stress the word starting, to build data tools to allow us to track and trace sustainability issues across value chain as well. So again, I see banks, I think Lloyds and NatWest are starting to create a suite of tools to help the SMEs that bank with them. How do you do a carbon calculator? What is it? I can't afford to do one myself. Well, here's a NatWest or a Lloyds tool to help you manage it within your business. So a lot of the best practice I'm seeing now is big businesses putting a friendly arm around their value chain, those that they lend to, those that they supply them, to help them navigate through this quite scary and intimidating issue in the marketplace at the moment.
And as we've been talking, a couple of key pillars have been kind of jumping at me from what you're saying, and that's kind of consistency, data, and people. And I kind of want to go back to what you're saying about mentoring a little bit earlier. Can you explain what you mean by mentoring in terms of the sustainability value a little bit more?
Let me explain what it meant for me, and then I'll broaden it out for that. So say, I work for a business of 84,000 people, you know, 70,000 working on the shop floor. It would have been very easy for Marks & Spencer to say with Plan A, we've just launched a 100-page report to 100 opinion formers, NGOs, governments, etc., to say M&S is going to become much greener. Just leave it to us. You know, you carry on making things, moving them, selling them to consumers. It's hard, it's challenging. But M&S said, no, we want everybody in this business to own it. So, you know, clearly that started with this concept of Plan A. So for 99% of the journey writing this 100-point plan, it was called Marks & Spencer's 100-point sustainability plan. Dull as freaking ditch water. And what happened is that the head of internal communications at the time, a guy called Robert Nuttall, just before I launched it, said, Mike, that's so dull. And he invented this brand, Plan A, because it's not Plan B for the one planet we've got. And it then meant whether you are reducing salt in food or improving Bangladeshi factories or high streets in Scotland or working with Kenyan farmers, it's all just Plan A. So there's this transformation brand that linked everybody's small activity into a bigger whole. The second thing we did, we listened. Because, you know, you could be in this sort of glass head office block in London and no idea what's happening elsewhere in the M&S. So we listened to colleagues. They came up with ideas. Mike, you know, you saw this waste here because the head office makes some stupid decisions. So we stopped it. The third thing we did is we invited the supply chains, again, in the same way into this. And we created a network of 5 green shops, 5 green factories, and 20 green farms where we trial every possible innovation. I mean, you find a third of it worked, you roll it out across all the other stores and factories and farms. A third of it needed tweaking, so it stayed there for a year to be perfected before it's rolled out. And a third was rubbish, you throw it in the bin. So that was the third aspect of it, was just making sure that we trialed and tested lots of new ideas. The fourth thing was what I talked about, the business case. That really drove deep engagement across the business. So everybody could think, okay, we're saving the planet, but in serving the planet, we're building a better M&S. Good. I'll support that in my busy life. And the fifth thing and the final thing was, again, we built networks of coaches and mentors, train the trainers. So there'd be 10 of us in the middle, but we'd make sure that every shop had a Plan A champion. They all had busy day jobs. They all did something, you know, front of house or back of house in the shop. But they put their hand up and said, I want to be the Plan A champion for my shop. And I want to encourage and mentor and guide my teams locally, rather than one person in the centre trying to do it all as well. So there are 5 things I've learned about the power of organisational coaching and mentoring.
Mm. Are you hopeful that we're going to achieve what you want to achieve?
Hey, $64,000 question. Let me sort of case for the prosecution, correct case for the defence. The case for the prosecution says the world's warmed by about 1.2 degrees and we're heading for probably about 3 degrees of warming by the end of the century. And you're probably listening, Mike, looking out quite a great, cool June day like me, thinking, really, does that matter? Context. The world was once about 5 to 6 degrees colder on average, 23,000 years ago, and a good half of the British Isles was under 1,000 metres of ice. It was the Ice Age. So if 5 or 6 degrees colder as a global average was enough to unleash 1,000 metres of ice above many of our heads, what does 3 degrees hotter look for 9 or 10 billion people struggling to survive on this planet? It is truly, truly existential. And the current government and corporate response to it is nowhere near enough. Let's be really clear. Just, you know, a few sort of press releases saying, yeah, I'll be net zero in 2040, 2050. Come back then and ask me how I'm getting on. So that's my case for the prosecution. I'm really worried. You know, I'm a scientist. I mentioned my 3 kids at the beginning of the discussion. What we're leaving them behind, what they're stepping into. The case for the defence says, but for the first time, the changes that we have unleashed are going from being small and niche exponential change. And again, you only have to look at the stats at the deployment of wind and solar around the world, the take up of EVs, to understand that change that takes years to get going suddenly goes off like a rocket. Now, I think the truth lies somewhere in the spectrum between those two extremes. I don't believe we're suddenly going to become a green, nice planet. Overall, again, the geopolitics of the world are quite complicated at the moment, so it's hard to get global agreements. And actually, as a pragmatist, one of the things that's spurring us in the right direction at the moment is the competition between China, the EU, and the USA for green growth. I talked about the Inflation Reduction Act in America. China's got its own version. The European Union's got its own version. These are not particularly nice people chasing green growth for all the reasons they should be chasing it. They just want jobs and growth and geopolitical advantage. But it's spurring things on. So I believe it is inevitable, in summary, that we are going to live in a climate-disrupted world. It is very much harder to live in than the one today. I don't want to sort of pretend otherwise. But I do think there's a way of navigating through that to minimise the harm on current generations and future generations as well. But it means we all need to get off our backsides and do it.
And Mike, if someone wants to get in touch with you to learn how to do that, how do they find you?
So I've got a website, www.mikebarryeco.earth. I've also got, you'll find me on LinkedIn, old person's sort of social media network, is it not? But I talk a lot on there about best practice. You know, about a third of what I say is a brick in everybody's pond to say we need to do more. But two thirds of it is very much about practical solutions and how people can move this forward.
Okay, fantastic. Mike, I really enjoyed that. Really, really insightful conversation. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure to join you. And I said to anybody listening, good luck. Keep our feet on the ground. Times are tough right now. But we all need to be part of a revolutionary better future.
That was Mike Barry. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Industry Leaders Podcast. And don't forget that you can catch up on all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for this week. So from me, Sarah Cole Boyle, and the team at More2, take care and bye-bye.